In the first two psalms tonight, so if you'll turn there, the first two psalms, when we look at the Bible, sometimes we can forget that the Jews actually had their own structure of the Old Testament. So for instance, the first and second Samuel, first and second Kings, first and second Chronicles were all one book. They weren't split into ones and twos. It was just Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. And then there were also times where we've seen some versions of what the Jews had where the prophets is just the prophets and it's all together. Sometimes we have a tendency to forget that the Jews didn't have it the way that we have it structured today. And there's some debate over whether or not Psalm 1 and 2 is actually one psalm. And one of the best arguments that I'd ever heard about this is that Psalm 1 and 2 together actually has somewhat of a chiastic structure to it. We've talked about chiasms before, but it's been a while, so if we forgot what exactly chiasms are, let's talk about those. So a chiasm is where you see something like this with usually poetry, but sometimes narrative has this as well in Jewish literature, or really any literature from that area, where what happens in the middle of your piece, whether it be your poem or your narrative work, that's really where the crux of everything lies. It's your most important point. And then you actually go out from there. So you sort of start with these outlier, you start and end with these outlier points, and as we continue on, we get closer and closer and closer. And then we hit our main point and we start to move back out. And why is this called a chiasm? Well, it's because it comes from the Greek letter chi. Yes, it's chi, not chi. Fraternity and sorority life has kind of ruined our pronunciation of Greek letters a little bit, but that's okay. It's chi, and it's just our letter X. And so if you take the letter chi and we cover up half of it, then you see where we get our little structure here. And so this is called a chiasm or a chiastic structure. And I would like to point out to you, Psalm 1 and 2 actually has a chiastic structure. And really, the primary point of Psalms 1 and 2 together is to contrast the righteous and the wicked. That's what, and they both talk about the righteous and the wicked, but what we're going to see is that the beginning of Psalm 2 in particular really has the crux of both psalms together. So let's investigate this a little bit. When we start out in Psalm 1, we have the first three verses. Let's read the first three verses here. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. So here we see the righteous man. Okay? This righteous man, notice that it's the way that he lives his life. He does not live by what fools tell him what to do. He follows what God tells him what to do. This idea of stand in the path of sinners is not trying to prevent sinners from sinning. That's not the idea there. It's that you're actually in the path as he's standing there that he's really following the path of sinners. No, he's not following the path of sinners. He's standing by streams of water. He's standing by life-giving water. And he does not sit in the seat of scoffers. He's meditating on the law of the Lord. That's what a righteous man does. And then in verses 4 through 6, we have a contrast. The wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So the idea here is he doesn't really talk about the wicked and how they live their life, per se, because we already have that contrast from the righteous in the first three verses. But instead of telling them what they are like or how they live, it tells us their outcome. The wicked are easily driven away. The idea there of chaff is while you're preparing the grain, the lighter parts are what are blowing away in the wind. It just takes them wherever it wants, instead of them staying for the purpose with which they were given. So not only are they driven away, but it also specifically mentions judgment, standing in the judgment. They will not be able to look the judge in the eye and have a defense. Sinners will not be able to stand in the assembly of the righteous. So not only will they not survive judgment, they won't be counted among the righteous. They cannot be counted among the righteous. The Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. God has told us what happens to the righteous. The way of the wicked leads to annihilation and destruction. And that leads us to Psalm 2. Psalm 2 then starts us off with the beginning of our pair of ideas. So really the most important concept in both Psalms is really right here from verses 1 through 7. So let's focus here on verses 1 through 3 first. Okay, we just had this contrast of the righteous and the wicked. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. Didn't we just read what happens to those people? They're like chaff that the wind drives away. They cannot stand in judgment or in the assembly of the righteous. Why? Because this is who they are. They must rebel against the Almighty. Let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. What they don't realize is there are stronger fetters awaiting them. Ones that they will be unable to escape from without the help of the Lord. Then verses 4 through 7. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. See, while the wicked are trying to cast off the fetters of God, the righteous are trying to be his children. The righteous are trying to be born in God rather than be shackled to him. When you consider what God has given you to be shackles, it's going to be hard to get you to think of it in any other way. It's not shackles, it's an inheritance. We are not slaves, we are sons. Prodigal sons, maybe, but sons nonetheless. And so note here these two ideas together. The wicked want to know how to get away from God, and the righteous want to follow the Son. The righteous want to be like the Son. The righteous want to be a child. And while they're busy thinking about how to tear their fetters apart, notice who these people are. Kings, rulers. See, these are people who, they don't want to lose the power and the authority that they have, forgetting all the while that it is God who gave it to them in the first place. And so while they're busy casting off the fetters that God has shackled them to Him, He's setting up a new kingdom. A kingdom in which, regardless, they will have no power or authority. And so they will lose their power and authority one way or the other. They can either deny the Lord, or they can join Him. And now look at what happens. Note the similarity between verses 8 through 10 and verses 4 through 6 of Psalm 1. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Notice what happens to the wicked. What happens to the wicked? They cannot stand in judgment. They cannot stand in the assembly of righteous, and they are like chaff. And it says here, verse 9, you shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Also notice it says that they will not be able to stand in judgment. And then in verse 10, he says, take warning, O judges of the earth. This judgment that you cannot stand, that judgment will be directed at you, you who are judging for yourselves. The righteous will have their inheritance. The righteous will rule. I want you to notice, it says, break them with a rod of iron and shatter them like earthenware. But how is that? How are we going to break and shatter them? Jesus actually tells us that in Matthew chapter 5. By being poor in spirit. By mourning. By hungering and thirsting after righteousness. By being a peacemaker. That's how we will shatter our enemies. And then look at the connection between the first three verses and verses 11 through 12. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, that He not become angry and you perish in the way, for His wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in Him. Notice how it started and how it ended. Verse 1, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. And it ends with, how blessed are all who take refuge in Him. Notice that when we have made Jesus our refuge, everything that gives us safety, there's no room for wickedness. It's not enough to just not do wickedness. Right? It's kind of like standing out in an open field in the middle of battle and thinking that, well, since I'm standing over here and the battle's over there, nothing bad will happen to me. It's not about not doing anything. It's about doing the right thing. It's about putting your refuge in the right place. And it's no great mystery why that is. He told us in verse 2 of Psalm 1. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. That's where it all comes back to. If that is where you're putting your focus, your time, your meditation, oftentimes I think we think of meditation as perhaps a sort of bogus Eastern hokum kind of thing. But that word meditation comes up all throughout the Bible. And instead of trying to empty your mind of everything, you empty your mind of everything but the Lord. That's what you're supposed to be meditating on. And if that's what you're meditating on, then 2 verses 1 and 3 won't mean anything to you. You're not going to be interested in casting off the fetters. You're interested in being a citizen of the kingdom in which Christ is king. I'm not interested in being released from God. I'm interested in being his citizen. The righteous and the wicked and the way they live is no surprise. It should not be a surprise to us. And it is fairly simple. But of course, we as human beings have to make it far more complicated than it ever needed to be in the first place. Meditate on the law and seek after the Lord. It's that simple. If that's what you're doing with your whole heart, with your whole mind, with your whole soul, with your whole strength, then you will never find yourself in the path of sinners, sitting in the seat of scoffers, or following the counsel of the wicked. And whether or not these two psalms were actually one psalm at one point, or whether they were two, it is interesting that we can see this connection between the two of them. That it's not just talking about the righteous and the wicked, it's talking about why they're the righteous and the wicked. And what will eventually happen to the righteous and the wicked. And we don't really know who wrote this. There's a few psalms, we don't have it recorded for us who wrote them. It's long been hypothesized to be David, since David wrote approximately 100 of them anyway. We tend to think it's David. But whoever did was really paying attention to the world around them. And it's no surprise then that that's the wisdom that God would give us. And while it is the wisdom of God, while it did come from the mind of God, it's surely something that we can look around and see for ourselves. And so when we think back to what we were talking about this morning, doing the hard things, when things are difficult that God has asked us to do, is it really easier to find ourselves following the counsel of the wicked? Is that really easier? Is it really easier to stand in the path of sinners or to sit in the seat of scoffers? Is that really the easier thing to do? Because what we often find is that suddenly our life gets further from us than we ever could have thought. It was one of the things that Jill and I were not prepared for when we started our adoption journey. Something that you get to see all the time are what are called intakes. And intakes are the forms that birth mothers have filled out. And there's lots of questions. There's usually about 5 or 6 pages of questions, maybe even longer, depending on the agency. And the birth mother is sort of outlining her situation and some medical history and the like. And they're encouraged to be honest, but we know they're not all honest. We actually looked at Bo's mom's intake after we had Bo. We didn't have her intake. We were just told about Bo, and we took him on. And then about a month later or so, her intake was sent to us, and there was a lot of error in the intake. But But even if these birth moms are being half honest, it's a dismal look at people's lives sometimes. And that is the danger that we find ourselves in. I'm going to live the life that I want. And I want to ask the question, this is really the life that you want? Are you sure about that? Because there's a lot of depression. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of anger, remorse, regret. And there's very little in the way of happiness or joy or peace. And it's just so sad, and it makes you want to adopt every child that comes on an intake, because there's no telling what they might get in the future. And this is why God warns us. This is why God tells us, I know what's best for you. And let me tell you, even if I struggled with that concept just a little bit, it doesn't take too much time of looking out there and seeing what that looks like to live the life that you want. And how quickly it becomes the life that you never, ever wanted. And the people who find themselves in those situations, God calls them the wicked. And sometimes we sit and say, well, they need help. They need mercy. They need compassion. All of that is true. These people need help. And the first place they need to go for help is the good Lord. That's what they've been missing their whole lives. We cannot make that mistake. And we cannot let others make that mistake. I've set it up here before. When I first heard it, though, I was very surprised at the wisdom of the statement, considering its source. But Penn Jillette, one half of the magic duo Penn and Teller, is a militant atheist. But he said he was working a show once, and there was a man who was helping him with his props. Most magicians will hire local people to help with props and that sort of thing. And he said the man would always, whenever he was passing, he would always look at him and look a little bit nervous. And finally, the last night, the show was over, and the man walks up to him and he says, sir, I know the kind of man that you are and the philosophy that you hold. I wanted you to have this. And he handed him a Bible. And he said, I just wanted you to know that I wish you would read this and learn what the Lord wants for you. And the interviewer that he was talking to, he said, I really appreciated that. I care nothing about the Christian God or the Christian Bible, and I still don't. But that man was so honest and earnest, I had to give him credit. And it made me realize you must really hate someone to never want to tell them about your wonderful God. And it's just so much wisdom from someone who otherwise shows such foolishness. Why are we going to let them out there? And if we took these shades down, you could see a whole bunch of people going by out there who are not in here. They're not in here. And we're letting them drive by. And we're not trying to figure out who any of these people are. We're not trying to tell them about our wonderful God and what he's done for them. Do you really hate your fellow human beings that much in order to let anything get in the way of you and them and the Lord? It's going to be hard. I might lose friends. I might lose my connections. Is that what you're going to stand there and look at them on the day of judgment? Why didn't you tell me about God? What are you going to say to him then? Because while they're staring down the fate of hell, it's going to seem rather trivial that you didn't say anything to them at all. We as the righteous, it is our responsibility to be resolved. The first words here, I am resolved no longer to linger, charmed by the world's delight. And while this is a message of I am resolved to become a child of God, I want you to think about this song slightly differently. I am resolved to make other children of God. I am resolved to go out there and bring other people to the Lord, to bring more and more disciples who will in turn make more and more disciples. That's the way God designed this group to be. And it's time that we stand up and do our due diligence to take responsibility, to do what God has said. We are the righteous. If we're meditating on God's word day and night, then we know how to speak to others about it. Tonight, I hope you are resolved. And if there's anything in your life that you need help with now, I want you to be resolved to come up here and handle it. It's very easy for us to say, I don't want to air out my dirty laundry. I don't think the church needs to know about that. That's something that's private. That's between me and the Lord. Well, if it's something that needs to be fixed and you aren't taking care of it, and you need us to help. And we will help you. There's no judgment here. There is only compassion, mercy, and a desire to help. Whatever you need tonight, please take advantage of this opportunity as we stand and as we sing.
I am.